Okay, some of the stuff we're talking about this morning, if you want to remember it, you might ought to take some notes. I'll try to type up something if there is a request for it on some of these issues. But boy, when you talk about a couple of thousand years of history, you wonder just what parts to put down on a paper and what parts not to put down on a paper. If there is a request for some of the charts or for some of the things that you'd like to have typed up, let me know. But the bulk of what we are going over today is just pure history. Now, we are coming to the end of church history. And when you study church history, there are two types. There is God's history, which you find in the Bible, and then there is secular history, which sometimes is written by Christians, but they are not inspired Christians. They are just making an effort to be accurate historians. In 2 Timothy 1 and verse 13, we've emphasized the idea of the standard. Hold the standard of sound words. In the first century church, there was standardized doctrine. There was standardized practice. And this is what we are looking for, the standardized doctrine and the standardized practice. These are the areas in which we are interested in it: worship, organization, and work. Now, one thing I would like to emphasize is when we talk about these things, essentially we are talking about the ideal picture of the early church in the first century. And one thing about that, that ideal picture that we talk about is really not that hard to see in the scripture. We used a quotation last week from Philip Schaff, written in 1883. I mean, this is from Union Theological Seminary. I mean, this is from, you know, a denominational source, looking back, writing history. And from what he said, there were no missionary societies, no missionary institutions, etc., etc. Historians can see it. Primitive simplicity in the church. And that's what we are interested in. But historians also recognize the fact that there was evolution that took place after the death of the apostles. Apostasy was coming. The writers in the New Testament warned about the coming apostasy, and it is amazing how quickly apostasy set in. By the time you get to 100 AD, the things that the apostles were warning about were rapidly taking place. We tend to think, and most of my life, this is the way it has been taught in studying church history. Apostasy began with the organization of the church. Normally stated that way. That's only partly true. When you talk about organizational departure, started with the bishop being elevated above the elders, and then they started making distinctions between bishops. The county bishop, the little country church bishop versus the big city bishop. And then finally the big city bishops from the provincial capitals were known as the metropolitans, and it really was a case where your status was determined by how important your city was. Wasn't determined by what kind of man you were. It's determined by where you happen to be. And then finally, we have five patriarchs at the most influential cities: Constantinople, Rome, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. And then finally, in 586, John the Faster in Constantinople was elected as universal bishop. And then the bishop at Rome said, no, that can't be. One man can't be over the church. But then in 606, in Rome, Boniface III was appointed universal bishop by the emperor. So the first universal bishop was voted in by his constituency in Constantinople. And then the second, which is usually where we start, we say first pope, 606, appointed by an emperor. That's a really brief summation of the organizational departure. Now, what I would argue is that the organizational departure was a response to doctrinal departure. Now, last week we were talking about things that we can see in the New Testament. When we look in the New Testament, some of the early doctrinal departures, we could start with Judaism, Acts the 15th chapter, circumcision. We could go to questions concerning the resurrection from the dead in 1 Corinthians 15. But then by the time we push up to about AD 100, even at the time of John, the last apostle, we can see the Gnostics coming in. It's pretty much undoubted that John lived to see the first Gnostic influence coming into the church. Cerinthus is the one that you'd probably consider the father of it. The Nicolaitans are also mentioned in the book of Revelation. But then we keep going farther into the 100s. We have the Ebionites, who had some lower ideas about Jesus. There were two classifications of the Ebionites. One thing about the Ebionites is pretty certain that they probably remnants of Judaistic teaching. We have the Ebionites. We have Montanism in 150 AD, which was a charismatic movement that kind of set everybody back on their heels. We have later Gnosticism in the mid-150s. Yes. Oh, okay. Marcion, Valentinus. And then by 315, we have Arianism. Jesus had a beginning. If he's the only begotten of the Father, then he couldn't be an eternal being. One thing about these ideas, you know, what goes around comes around, some of the things that we still argue about. For instance, if you talk to a Jehovah's Witness, is Jesus a created being? Yeah. That's Arianism. That goes way back. If you talk about charismatic movements, that goes way back. A lot of these things are recycled over and over again. So these were things that were coming into the early church, and like I say, I would argue that the corruption of organization was kind of in response to some of these things, because when the war's on, principle gets pushed aside. You start doing things because we got to win, even if we have to cut some corners, even if we have to ignore some principles. We got to win. We got to tighten things up here and put the hammer down on somebody. And when you start pushing principles aside, you open the door for certain classes of people. For instance, religious profiteering. In wartime, is there black market profiteering? Does anybody make money during war? A lot of people make money during war. Do some people use it as opportunity to gain power? Definitely. Now, during this period of time, when you have this organizational development and all this error coming in, an attitude was developing among those who looked at themselves as the descendants of the apostles. The attitude is, obviously, we're right because we have a historical link to the apostles. Jesus gave the truth to the church, and we're the church, so we're the custodians of the truth. And Jesus gave the scriptures to the church, and we're the church, so we're the ones that are going to tell you how the scripture should be interpreted. We have the right of interpretation. We made a little comparison last week. We think about the Jews at the time that Jesus came into the world. They were given the law of Moses. They had their priesthood. They developed their tradition, and they reached the point where their tradition trumped the law. You know, Jesus tells them in Mark 7, you know, you've got your tradition where you just throw your mom and dad out. You say, I gave it to God. You set aside the law of God to keep your tradition. Well, that same path is being followed over here beginning about AD 100 and on. The apostles delivered the gospel of Christ, but the priesthood developed. Last week, talking about the organizational departure, there was a separation between clergy and laity. And the rationale for that was, well, the Jews had a priesthood, we need a priesthood. So we develop our separate priesthood just like they had one, and at the same time we develop our tradition, and we reach the point where, that wasn't good, where tradition trumps law, just like over here with the Jews. It's the tradition that really matters. And that is really one of the prime characteristics of Catholic thinking. And if you really get down to what drove Catholicism to where it was, it was this same path. We are the custodians of the truth, so when we take the scripture, we tell you what it means. You don't have the right of private interpretation. Our tradition tells you what the scripture really means. And our tradition really trumps anything. So if somebody says apostasy in the early church, what were the things that caused it to happen? We have the concentration of power. We have the concentration of power, the synods and the councils. The idea that we decide what is true and is not true. I mean, we decide what we believe, we decide what we're going to practice in light of the scripture, but we don't decide what is true and is not true. And then attitude towards scripture. We have the right of interpretation. We'll tell you what it means. These were the things that drove things in that direction. And again, this is an effort to fight against what was perceived as errors coming in. And there is one more thing that we will add to it, and that is link with government. Church and state getting wrapped up with each other. Can anybody tell me the real date where you put your thumb down and say, boy, this is where you can really say church and state are together? AD. And you can etch that one in stone. Because that is the Nicene Council, which was called by Constantine. Prior to 323, say from the days of the Apostle Paul to 300, Rome's attitude toward Christians was up and down, but for most of the time when it was down to the point where they'd kill you. That was a problem. In Acts 25 and verse 10, the Apostle Paul is on trial and he says, I appeal to Caesar. Who was Caesar at the time when he appealed to Caesar in Acts 25 and verse 10? The Roman emperor. Who? What was his name? To what emperor did Paul appeal? Nero. Nero started out okay. When he got older, he became very self-indulgent. But when Nero started his reign, he was under the guidance of older guys, and Paul appealed to Nero. And he was set free. And after that, we have the pastoral epistles. And then Rome burnt Nero needed a scapegoat, and then everything started going south from there. For the next 250 years, it was off and on Roman persecution and murder of Christians. So all during this period that we're talking about, up to 325, you have false teachers coming in. You have the departure in organization. You have the Roman government persecuting off and on. This is all coming together. And then finally, around the year 300, you have this guy, Constantine. Constantine is the emperor who splits power with a guy named Licinius. Licinius made life miserable for Christians. Constantine and Licinius finally had it out, and Constantine won. Now, Constantine was a man. I don't know how sincere he was. Probably nobody does, but Constantine would call himself a Christian. When he finally prevailed against Licinius and became the emperor of the Roman Empire, he commanded that the clergy be held in honor. Now, when you say we command the clergy to be held in honor, all of a sudden, what happens? What happens to the power of the clergy? The power of the clergy just all of a sudden starts to skyrocket. All of a sudden, they have official sanction from Constantine, the emperor. Now, when Constantine becomes the emperor in 324, where he has all of it, he's not split in power, he looks around and he knows that the Christians have this tendency to call councils to decide issues. And he is a religious guy. And he wants unity within Christendom. You know, he looks at all these bishops and patriarchs and all this struggle to see who's going to be the big cheese. And he says, you know, we need some unity. The first thing we're going to do is we're going to call a council and get everybody together, and we're going to decide some of these questions so that we can have unity. The first thing we're going to talk about is we're going to talk about Arianism. We're going to decide on Arianism, and we're going to decide about the proper day to observe Easter, and we're going to talk about some of these bishops. What about these bishops? Well, some of these bishops, when the Romans persecuted, they say, okay, you can either burn some incense to the Roman gods, or we're going to torture you or kill you. And some of them recanted. For instance, Eusebius, this guy. Now, he's a historian. I mean, we quote him. But this is one of the reasons why when you get to talking history, you kind of say, wait a minute, this is human history. Eusebius, everybody knows Eusebius. Well, one other bishop known by Eusebius, they were trying one guy on the charge of, well, some of the things we're talking about here. And this friend of Eusebius says, wait a minute, Eusebius, you're sitting there to try this guy. You and I were both in the same prison. The Romans had us both. I don't have this eye anymore. They took my eye out. Where are your scars? What did you do, Eusebius, to keep yourself from being mangled by the Romans? So the odds are pretty good that this Eusebius, even though he's a respected historian, was one of the ones that bailed and said, okay, I'll burn incense to the gods. Well, what this controversy was about is some of these bishops that recanted their testimony, recanted their faith in Jesus. After it was all over, they thought they ought to get their job back and be a bishop again. And actually it was decided that most of them could. You know, you can deny Christ, come right on back. But these were issues that Constantine wanted settled at the Nicene Council in 325. So here we have the Roman Emperor calling everybody together because we have to settle these issues, and the issues are settled. So what we have now is real cooperation between church and state. Yes?
Did you say, what about
Pardon me?
Did you say they decided something about Jesus?
About Arianism, they decided Arians were heretics. And Eusebius also probably was an Arian. Anyway, like we say, now we have real cooperation between church and state. Now, just off the top of your head, when you see church and state linked up together, I mean tight, you see potential for damage there? Who will probably get the worst of it? Probably the church, but it's kind of funny, the state did too. The way this thing played out, for the next 800 years, now we've been talking about skipping big blocks of time. We're going to skip some big blocks of time. We're going to come up to about the year 1100. Now I'm going to be doing quite a bit of reading. You just have to listen. And after the reading is done, we will try to, you know, get into what was actually said. Put your mind right here. Constantine gets church and state together. It develops into the future by 588. Now keep in mind, this is like 250 years before you have the universal bishop, John the Faster, so it's still got a ways to go. But it's developing. The church is kind of following the Roman model, provincial capitals, organization, the whole thing. We come up to 1100. Sometimes a decree of excommunication against a king or a powerful noble was fortified by placing an interdict upon the area over which he ruled. The interdict, by withholding most of the benefits of religion from a ruler's subject, was intended to kindle both resentment against him and force him to submit to the church. What's happening? By 1100. If the Pope, okay, this is whatever country you want that to be, we'll call that Germany. If the Pope doesn't like what the German monarch is doing, what does he do? Puts an interdict on him. He says, okay, no sacraments are going to be administered in Germany until the king starts doing things the way I want him to do. Okay, what are sacraments all about? Back up a little bit. There had, of course, been priests and sacraments in the church long before the 11th century, but neither the exact functions of the priest nor the precise nature of the sacraments had ever been clearly formulated. The theory now came to be held that the priest, by virtue of his ordination by a bishop and the latter's confirmation by the Pope, was the inheritor of a portion of the authority conferred by Christ upon the Apostle Peter. In effect, this meant that the priest had the power to cooperate with God in performing certain miracles and in releasing sinners from the temporal consequences of their wickedness. What's that mean? All right, I'm not going to write it out. Here's Jesus. Here's Peter. Here's the present Pope. Here's the bishop. Here's the priest. Down the line, the priest has inherited some power from Jesus down through the Pope. So the priest has power to do what? Where your sin is concerned. You're not getting forgiveness without him. Basically. The Pope gets it, and he just passes a little of the authority down to you. So realistically, it's a situation where the priest really does stand between you and God. It was primarily a result of Peter Lombard's influence that the number of sacraments came to be accepted as 7. The 7 were, and still are, baptism, confirmation, penance, the Eucharist or Lord's Supper, marriage, ordination, and extreme unction, or the last rites administered to the dying. The Roman Church defines a sacrament as an instrumentality whereby divine grace is communicated to man. All right, what's a sacrament? Forget instrumentality, that's too hard a word. A sacrament is a rite that communicates grace. Every once in a while, you'll hear me use an illustration talking about grace. Sometimes people have the concept that grace is kind of like an ointment that God puts on your head, almost like it has some kind of substance to it. This is kind of where the idea comes from. A sacrament, baptism, Lord's Supper, marriage, last rites, communicates divine grace. It's like grace is a substance, we'll rub it on your head when you go through the ceremony. It communicates grace to you just because the priest is doing it to you. Yes. All right. Baptism, confirmation, penance, the Eucharist, marriage, ordination, and extreme unction. Extreme unction is last rites. Pardon me? Okay, try it again. Baptism, confirmation, penance, that's three. The Eucharist, four. Marriage, five. Ordination, six. Extreme unction, seven. Okay, those are the last rites. So, the priest has inherited authority to administer sacraments. Without that sacrament, you're not going to have divine grace. The priest cooperates with God in this and in certain miracles. Now, that is the doctrine, which means it is absolutely essential that you have the blessing of the priest. You can't be saved without it. And another part of the doctrine was that when the priest administers these sacraments, it's automatic regardless of the character of the priest. Regardless of the character of the, I don't know about the receiver, but it ought, I think they're more concerned with maintaining the dignity of the priest. Now, why would they say it doesn't matter what the character of the priest is? They were rotten. And they knew it. And you still had to uphold the dignity of the institution. Now, the question becomes again, how does one use this kind of power? Well, if the German Holy Roman Emperor is not doing what the Pope wants him to do, he says, okay, you don't want to play ball? No priest is going to perform the sacraments. When your babies are born, they're all going to hell. And pretty soon, what happens? The people in Germany are not ready, really happy with the emperor, and they are ready to rebel. Yes. That didn't come out till later. I don't believe. Yeah, a lot of this developed because in 325, they already had novation sprinkling if you're sick and can't be immersed. But I don't think infant baptism had come around by then. Yes. Well, that comes up right now. As far as, you know, that kind of thing. Read a little bit from something that happened later. This is about 1150. Conflict between Pope Gregory and the German Emperor Henry IV. And we'll take a little while to read it. The two great opponents in the first stage were Pope Gregory VII and the German Emperor Henry IV. The quarrel between these powerful rivals was a direct outgrowth of the new Cluny movement, of which Gregory had been the leader for some time before he became Pope. As noted previously, one of the fundamental aims of this movement was to free the church from secular control. During a period of many years, the practice had been established that a bishop, abbot, or priest who held his position as a fief should be invested with the symbols of his office by the king or noble who granted the fief. This practice was known as lay investiture and was a thorn in the side of such zealous reformers as Gregory. They feared that as long as the clergy owed allegiance in any degree to secular overlords, papal supremacy would be impossible. But this was not the only issue involved. There was also the question of the Pope's right to exercise temporal authority. Just how much temporal jurisdiction Gregory intended to claim is not clear. We'll stop there. You talk about armies, or this is the time when the Pope would want to exercise temporal oversight, and they did have armies, yes.
What is temporal oversight?
With an army, as opposed to spiritual oversight. Yeah, Gregory was a kind of a head knocker. The quarrel between Henry and Gregory was one of the most bitter in the Middle Ages. When Henry refused to obey decrees of the Pope prohibiting lay investiture, oh, and again, lay investiture is the idea that the king had the right to appoint this guy in the church. When Henry refused to obey decrees of the Pope prohibiting lay investiture, Gregory threatened to excommunicate him. The king retaliated by denouncing the Pope as a false monk and ordering him to descend from the throne to be damned throughout the ages. Whereupon Gregory not only excommunicated Henry, but declared his throne vacant and released all his subjects from allegiance to him. See, the Pope could say, "Y'all don't have to listen to the king anymore." Faced with revolt by his vassals, Henry had no alternative but to make peace with the Pope. How he journeyed over the Alps in the depth of winter to Canossa in northern Italy and implored the Pope's forgiveness is a familiar story and need not be recounted here. Later on, Henry had his revenge when he led an army into Italy, set up an anti-pope, and compelled Gregory to flee from Rome. The great apostle of reform died in exile in 1585. That's the kind of thing that's going on in the Middle Ages. The popes and the kings are having it out to try to figure out just exactly who it is that has power in this world. One more little reading on this point. Something y'all may not know. The second stage of the conflict had momentous results not only for medieval Europe, but for subsequent ages as well. For a time, the popes were almost uniformly successful. With the aid of the Lombard cities and the rebellious dukes in Germany, they checked the ambition of the Holy Roman emperors and finally broke the power of the empire entirely. By means of interdicts, Innocent III compelled Philip Augustus to take back the wife he had repudiated and forced King John to recognize England and Ireland as fiefs of the papacy. At the beginning of the 14th century, however, Boniface VIII went down to humiliating defeat at the hands of King Philip the Fair of France. As the outcome of a quarrel over Philip's attempt to tax the property of the church, Boniface was taken prisoner by the king's soldiers, and a month later he died. The Archbishop of Bordeaux was chosen to succeed him, and the papal capital was transferred to Avignon in France, where it remained for 70 years. There were also other results. Many pious Christians now came to believe that the popes were carrying their ambitions for political power too far and were forgetting their spiritual functions. As a consequence, the papacy lost prestige and the way was open for repudiation of its leadership, even in religious affairs. In like manner, papal meddling in internal politics of different countries tended to strengthen the growth of national feeling, particularly in England and France. Did you realize that there was a time when the Vatican is in Italy, but in a sense, for 70 years, the Vatican was in France? I mean, how many of us even know that? These are the kinds of things that are going on in the Middle Ages, and some of it just kind of blows your mind. By the way, if you think people didn't know, people didn't realize, if you read a book like The Count of Monte Cristo, We're all familiar with the story, the Count of Monte Cristo. If you actually read the book, it becomes clear. You know, the people understood what was going on. The guy that the hero meets in the prison, the old guy that kind of sets him going in the right direction with the treasure, the reason he was in prison was because the Pope wanted his treasure. You know, that's why he's there. So they pretty much knew what was going on during that time. Now, if we talk about first century Christianity, we try to paint the picture of the ideal first century Christianity. It's gone from what we see in the book of Acts to what we see here in the days of Constantine to what we see in the Middle Ages. You know, the Pope's fighting with the king to see who's going to be top dog. Please turn to Ezekiel chapter 10. This is Ezekiel's temple vision. Time of the Babylonian captivity. The prophet Ezekiel, who is a captive in Babylon, sees a vision concerning the temple in Jerusalem. In Ezekiel 10 and verse 18, "Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. When the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose up from the earth in my sight, and the wheels beside them. And they stood still at the entrance of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the God of Israel hovered over them." What are we looking at in Ezekiel 10? Temple vision, what happens? God leaves the building. He is no longer there. He has departed. In 1 Kings, when Solomon dedicates the temple, the glory of the Lord fills the temple. That was a sign that this is God's house. In the temple vision at the time of the captivity, he sees a vision. The cherubim leave the temple. He's not there. All right. Thinking about this for a moment, did it take a long time to reach the point where God finally said, "I'm not there"? Was he very patient with his people? Finally reached the point, "I have departed." Don't answer this question. Just think about it. The glory left the temple. When we talk about the church as it was set up by the apostles, all through this process that we're talking about, at what point did he leave the building? If we talk about the church as set up by the apostles, it is changing. It's morphing into something else. It's morphing into something else. Excellent point. Hang on to that thought. Think about this too. We think about Elijah weeping and mourning and crying and says, "God, I alone am left." What was God's answer? "No, you're not. You just think you are." Is there always a remnant? You know, that's the question. Just let you think about that. Yes. Yeah, the removing of the lampstand, I would, parallel to this idea, God leaves the building in Ezekiel 10. At what point? Sometimes it's difficult from our perspective to know. But one thing shines out in the scriptures, this concept of a remnant. Yes. Yeah. Or somebody says, I think what we need here is to elevate one guy and call him a bishop. Anytime you have this departure, it indicates, like you say, I know better than God. What is it that we're trying to accomplish? If we say, you know what, even historians look back at the primitive simplicity and they can see it and know that people walked away from it, eventually what's the answer going to be? God says in Jeremiah 6:16, the ancient path, where is the good way, and walk in it. That's the effort that you make. That's what you try to do. One thing that becomes obvious when you start looking at history from 325 and finally get down into the Middle Ages, they could have cared less what the old path was, because they determined that they had the right to map out the path themselves. Now, everything that we've talked about really led to the evolution of what we would call Catholicism. But then historically, we come to the Protestant Reformation. If you had to assign a date for the Protestant Reformation, this is the etched in stone recognized starting date for the Protestant Reformation. There's no one good answer, but the answer you'd usually get would be what? 1517 A.D., when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door of the chapel in Wittenberg, Germany. That's the date historians would give. If somebody says, okay, the causes of the Protestant Reformation, what led up to that? You had some worldly causes. What do you mean worldly causes? All right, somebody correct me if I spell this wrong. The Renaissance. What's the Renaissance?
Humanism.
Essentially, it's humanism. You think of, the Michelangelos and the Leonardos and people like that. It's essentially if people just kind of started thinking very humanistically, but to think at all, you had to kind of be in defiance of the established religion. So you had the Renaissance that was taking place leading into that. You also had nationalism. What is nationalism? I care about my country. I am German. I am English. I care about my country. Why is it that all the taxes I pay end up in Italy? That came to be a big, big problem in the minds of people. These are worldly causes for the Protestant Reformation, and then there are religious causes for the Protestant Reformation. Number one, the corruption of the priesthood. Now, this is almost unfair, and it's also unwise, because when you have so many scandals regarding the priesthood, and sexual predators. Everybody wants to pile on, and that's always kind of dangerous, because are the Catholics the only ones that have predators hidden in the closet? No, they are not. But it became very evident, you know, extremely evident. Now, back at this point in time, for instance, Pope Leo, 8 illegitimate children that they knew of. Okay, well, wait a minute, that wasn't Leo, that was Pope Innocent. Didn't it seem funny to have a name like Pope Innocent when they know you've got 8 illegitimate kids? That was Pope Innocent. Pope Leo made $1 million a year selling offices. And that's back when $1 million was a lot more than $1 million. I mean, this is high-end corruption. Corruption of the priesthood, the sale of, let's write some of it down, corruption, relics, sale of relics and indulgences. Now, essentially, we talk about selling indulgences. What do we mean by selling indulgences? You're essentially paying in advance. You know, you can do this and you won't have to spend any time in purgatory for it. A relic, the sale of relics. Erasmus, who was a real scholar, you did a Greek translation of the scriptures, one of the standard texts from which the New Testament is translated. Erasmus made the comment that there are enough pieces of the cross scattered in the churches to build a ship. Martin Luther said of the Archbishop of Mainz, said that he had a pound of the wind that the Lord blew on Elijah at Mount Horeb. This was stuff that they had for sale. Now, and lastly, you know, you'd put papal taxation. You know, essentially the church would send you a bill. You were expected to give 10% of your income, pay your tithe just as a matter of course, and then yearly there was an annual levy on every family in addition to this 10%. And all the money flowed to Italy. Hand. Pardon me? Yeah. 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 With Martin Luther, one of the first things he did was change the service to German. If you think of Martin Luther and think of somebody talking English, don't think that way. You know, Martin Luther was German. Now, at this time, because of all these things that are going on heading up toward this date, the Pope is losing influence. It's going downhill. And when Boniface, remember we talked about Philip the Fair capturing the Pope, and the Pope died, and the headquarters was moved to Avignon, France. That was a big hit to papal status. And all of this kind of flowed into what we'll be picking up with next week. Thank you.